Oh, no, it wasn't.
Something wrong with you when you do things that way.
Okay, this is continuing the interview with James Boyd on November 1st. Yes, okay. So you were handling these two jobs at the same time, more or less.
Yeah, well, I had the title.
Right.
Actually, Tom Miller was a highly experienced, mm-hmm. fine man. I wanted him to take my place when I was doing, but he wouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't like the way I got treated. So
were called in, and...
And he'd been there before I got there. He was assistant director before I got there. So
he
reported directly to me, and we were close, and still are, close friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have any question. That left me free to do the interdepartmental work, which should have been done by the assistant secretary.
Mm-hmm.
And to be the defense minerals administrator, then I had Jim Douglas to do much of the routine work. So I,
mm-hmm.
And we had, by this time I had two secretaries. One was my Bureau of Mines secretary, who had been there since the second director, way back in the early days.
Mm.
A wonderful woman.
Maybe you mentioned once that you had a secretary. I wonder if this is the one who didn't know how to greet you. She would say, "Good morning, Colonel, Dr. Dean."
Oh, no, that was that was the Secretary of Interior's receptionist. She sat outside the secretary's office, and you go in there and you talk to her, and she'd say, "Well, Mr. Director, Dr. Colonel Dean Jim." She'd go through this rigmarole every time I go in there.
Well, it is a problem. I've wondered when I write letters to you how I should address
it. I don't use any of them.
So many titles.
I prefer to be called Mr. I never.
Do you really?
I never put the doctor on.
Mm-hmm.
I got three doctor's degrees, so I guess you can call me.
Yes, you could select any of several distinguished titles here.
Yeah, you know, that's putting on the airs.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need that.
So somebody called you in then, and you felt you were being fired, and
this was the undersecretary.
Mm-hmm.
He came from Arizona, and he let's go back to the synthetic fuels thing.
Okay.
We had worked up a plan, and Ferdinand Eberstadt in New York, remember I worked with him during the war.
Yeah, yes.
He and his people had worked together and built a corporation to build a synthetic fuels plant which would make benzene, as the chemical I've been talking about, out of coal. Well, that had been quite an expensive plant, and we looked at that time the oil industry wasn't able to do it. Well, while we were working this up, the oil industry solved the problem. They began to produce benzene normally in their refineries.
Hmm.
So I called Ferd and I told him that you're not going to like this, but I don't think we should go ahead with it. So I told the secretary, I said, I think we ought to not go ahead with that plant, because we don't need in wartime to be doing something unnecessary. Well, he had committed himself politically, I think, and this was a blow to his something he had done to set up a synthetic fuels plant in here in the wartime. We'd do it, and I think that was the cause of my. I don't know, there must have been other things I did. I was also opposing the subsidization of the lead zinc industry. We had already done a lot of that. I felt that we would be creating lead and zinc mines, which would we didn't need any more lead and zinc. I couldn't justify it anymore. And I was objecting to spending government money in wartime on expanding an industry. And I think I made some enemies for that.
Where were the lead and zinc mines?
Oh, down in Missouri and in New Mexico,
mm-hmm.
in Utah, all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, of course, didn't need any such help. They were pretty good.
So you were snubbing a number of congressional...
Yeah. Districts, probably.
Districts.
I think that. People did. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, I
now
told...
Now, who was president by now? Was
Truman still
president. Truman was still president, yeah. Okay.
He was still president.
That's right.
Till I left there.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, they fired me, see. But, of course, they couldn't fire me from the bureau, director of the bureauship, because Mr. Truman had appointed me, and we'd gone through holy hell to get confirmed. And, everybody knew the president had trouble with that. And I said, you realize, of course, if you fire me from this job, that I have to resign. You haven't got any confidence in me to do that job. I've got to resign from the bureau. It was about time I did anyway.
This was firing you from the director...
From the Defense
Minerals
Administration.
Administration.
Now, that was a direct appointment by the Secretary of Interior. It didn't involve the presidential appointment.
Okay, all right.
Although we had to have death presidential approval.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they knew that Mr. Truman, he knew me well enough to know that who I was and what we went through together. And... So I said, I'd call him on the phone an hour or two later. I said, Dick, what was his name? Dick something. He's coming back. You know, I think I'm going to go off. I need a vacation. I'm not going to resign just yet. So I took the family. I hadn't had a vacation in years, months.
Yeah.
I took them down to the shore and sat up there. And then... Freeport Sulphur, the very famous wealthy man that owned and ran that was the chairman of the board. They called me up and asked me if I would come in and help them announce the establishment of a new sulphur dome off the coast of Louisiana. I can't remember the name offhand, but I had battled because we were suddenly running out of sulfur, and sulfur is a very essential material in the chemical industry, particularly in wartime. And they had 2 and 3 days hearings on the Hill about what we should do about forcing the industry to do it, and I stood up firmly and said, no, the industry can solve these problems. They can't do it overnight, but they were... as aware as we are that we need more sulfur. And they'll expand their plants, and they wanted me then to come in, because I'd done this, to be there to announce this plan. Then I told them I was resigning from the Bureau of Mines, and they were about to offer me a job. But in the meantime, I'd been working with Charlie Cox in Kennecott on some other things, and they had lost the executive vice president and the outgoing president and the new incoming president of the airplane accident
up in Canada.
In Alaska, when some big guy blew his wife up and went with him.
That was terrible.
So he came and offered me a job. He said, you can have one of three jobs, whichever you want.
Mm.
And I took the exploration job because I thought I'd know more about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back and then said that I will resign. And Charlie wanted me the 1st of October. He made up his mind I was coming, and he was short of executive personnel,
mm-hmm.
and he wanted me right in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I said, well, now I've got to. So I said to the undersecretary, let us wait till the secretary gets back before we announce this thing. And Oscar Chapman got back, I went in to see him. And in the meantime, they had drawn up a reorganization of the Defense Minerals Administration to appoint one of my assistants in the oil shale business, who knew nothing about all this kind of stuff at all, a very bright scientist. And it changed everything I'd set up and done. They negated it. And I put it before Oscar Chapman, and I said, look at this, we worked this out together, we got the organization planning together. I'm leaving, and they wanted to do all this. He said, what do you want me to do with that? I said, well, tear it up. So he tore it up right there.
Oh.
I said, now I've got to tell you, I've got to resign, because you actually essentially fired me as administrator, and I've got to go. I mean, you're going, obviously haven't, the public eye got confidence under me, so I'm leaving. Of course, I wanted to leave anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good excuse to get out of there.
Uh-huh.
And again, it could offer me a job. So I never really was out of a job. They paid me up for the last minute.
Mm-hmm. A question occurred to me, but it's gone now. I can't remember what it was.
Now we're coming into industry. I think that's about all.
Yeah. Oh, I wanted to. I thought you might mention here the clubs that you belong to in Washington. Did you belong to them at this time?
Well, I belonged to the Cosmos Club in Washington. I didn't belong to Burning Tree. I never had time to play golf.
I was thinking you didn't have much time for golfing in these years, did
and,
you?
And when I, later on, when I retired and was going down there just to work, get be useful, I got my friends to put me up at Burning Tree,
that's
and I got him. I had to wait for 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
There's only about 5 years left to belong to it.
Were you playing golf at all in these years? In the Army or no?
Well, yes, I was when I was with Connecticut.
But
and with Copper Range, I was playing golf at Blonde Westchester Country Club. Yeah.
But not now when you were in Washington with the Bureau.
Oh, no.
No.
I hadn't played golf since I was a child with my father in Australia.
I see.
Oh, there was a little golf club when I was in college, and we'd occasionally go up and play a game. But,
Did you ever play tennis?
Yes, I played tennis with
Australians are supposed to be.
Yeah, I played tennis and would never commit competitively.
But swimming was your
swimming
thing.
Swimming was my principal.
Did you have any time for swimming during these years in Washington? I'm sure you weren't swimming in Germany, but
I didn't. Well, I did later when I left. Industry went down.
No. And so Cosmos Club was your club.
That was my club.
Were you meeting people from industry and so on?
Cosmos Club was primarily a scientific club. Not very many people from industry in there.
I see.
Some.
Uh-huh.
But it's really the gathering of the great brains in Washington. And from every walk of life.
How did you happen to join it? Who invited
first of all, Bill Rather, who was the director of the Geological Survey, was a member, and I'm sure I think he put me up.
Mm-hmm.
And then George Harris, the photographer, was an old member of the Cosmos Club, and he got a hand in it. So I had lots of powerful friends that would.
By now
I'm sure I didn't have the technical or scientific. I had written some papers, so my family must have had enough to get in.
Well, you had said when you first went to Washington that you didn't know anybody, and then.
Yeah.
You know, you.
Well, that was during the war.
Right, and then.
By the time I went back the second time, and of course I knew everybody.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What about your wife? Did she have activities that are worth mentioning? We should mention. I shouldn't put it.
Most of our life after we didn't have any children for several years, 5 or 6 years before Brown came up. Brown was born in. We were married in 1932, and Brown was born in 1938. So it was six years before the first child.
She continued to teach school at that time, didn't she?
Yes, I was still teaching school.
And
then the two younger ones were born.
All right. Okay, so there were five people who went with you, you said?
No, they wanted to come.
Oh, who wanted to come?
Yeah, I took my secretary and the research director, but I had him quit first, and then when he quit, then later on I picked him up.
But there were others
who had come in and talked to him, yeah.
Well, that was a credit to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I took some people from Bureau of Mines, too, that when they saw the way I was treated in the Bureau of Mines. Besides Feiss, there was another fellow that I made one of the regional directors, exploration directors,
mm-hmm.
in Connecticut, and he... In fact, I would prefer to him to have been my successor, but Cox picked Mary Burgess.
That one.
So that's about how important it is.
Uh-huh.
But then when we moved to Connecticut,
mm-hmm.
The children were off to school, and Ruthie began to get to a point where I could see that she was missing the activities of
mm-hmm.
forced activity. We had help in the house, we had a gardener, we had a full-time maid, and we had a lady that came in to clean, and who was lived in the garden outside, and her husband did the gardening.
Mm-hmm.
So, and she loved that house.
Mm-hmm.
It was 28 rooms.
This is when you went with Kennicott now?
No. When we went with Kennicott, we got the house first up in Scarsdale. That was the house I bought. I sold the house in Maryland and bought the house in Scarsdale. And then it became, by this time we had four children. I mean, the house was big enough, and we had a live-in maid who lived in the back of the house. But then it became obvious that our parents were getting old. And then we realized that this house wasn't big enough. So we looked around, and Ruthie went. Clemmy and I mix up our previous stuff.
Yes, it's easy to do, don't you?
But we don't. That doesn't bother either.
No.
And so she went hunting all over the place, and she found this lovely house in Greenwich. She mm-hmm. adored it, and so we bought it and moved there. And then my her mother died. And the father had a stroke, so we moved him. We had a room on the second floor in the back of the house with our own bathroom and out from all the noise of the house. And we bought him the first colored television set. And
wow.
The boys used to go up there and sit and watch the television with him.
Mm.
He had a wonderful time. He said he didn't know any old man that had ever find a retirement
that
either.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason he retired from being a doctor is because he had a stroke and he didn't trust his judgment anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Then my mother...
Yeah, we haven't mentioned your family for years. They were in California all this time?
All this time they lived in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
Dad was still he managed the mines in Death Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he retired, they put him on as a consultant. And paid him the rest of his life as a consultant. And he did the work on other things, and he was free to do any other consulting
work. Now, didn't he also have a connection with the Mudd family, you told me?
Yeah, that's why he had a consulting practice, and Harvey Mudd had him
mm-hmm.
working on the cactus gold mine in the Mojave Desert.
But he was continuing with the...
With the Borax Company.
The Borax Company.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Pacific Coast Borax Company.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He still remained one of the 20 mules.
Mm-hmm.
And
And your mother was still alive?
Well, oh yes, she was alive. Dad had got uranium poisoning.
Mm.
And he was in the hospital when the AIME was in Los Angeles. So I'd go up and visit him and talked about his friends. And then I went back with Upton Denver and I mentioned this to Dr. Brown. And he said, well, you know, that's terminal. I'm like, I didn't know this. And Christian Science wouldn't admit it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And when I left, Mother said he gave up.
Mm.
And he was in pain and he passed on. Because he looked forward to my coming up and seeing him.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's he went. And then Mother moved out of the house they lived in into an apartment on Wilshire Boulevard. And there was a Christian Science practitioner. Their name was Rock. They used to be Rockefeller, but they dropped the fella.
Oh, really?
The distant relatives of the Rockefeller. And they kept eye on him, but we decided that she belonged with us, and so we brought her back to this. There was one reason we bought this house in Greenwich, we wanted her back there with Dr. Brown.
Hmm.
So she had a room on the first floor, and he was a room on the second floor, and she had a heart problem. But he passed on a year after she came there.
Hmm.
But we had those two. Plus then the children were still all coming home for holidays and so forth. Mm-hmm. They're all bringing their friends. So we needed more than the little house in Greenwich and the scars they would give us.
Uh-huh. Well,
and that was a good investment anyway. We doubled the money when we sold it. The price we paid. And then we took this thing and bought the, well, you don't care about this thing.
Well, now when did, we haven't mentioned your AIME connection, of course that comes, your presidency of that was somewhat later, I guess. But, gotten you up now to being fired from the Bureau and going with Kennicott.
I was with Kennicott, and my job was exploration manager.
Vice President.
And at that time we still had excess profits taxes, which meant that any failures we had in exploration, any money we spent on exploration, when we wrote off the property, could be deducted as a loss. And so it was costing us about 10 cents on the dollar to do exploration.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were out me to do it. And there was a vice president of Kennicott by the name of Tony Anton Gray, who had been connected with the discovery of the copper mines in Africa. He'd been in on that deal. And he also had been working with his friends, and he married an English woman. They had two children.
Where in Africa was this?
He was in, what's now, Northern Rhodesia. What's the name of that Northern Rhodesia now?
Oh, goodness, I don't know.
Zimbabwe. Southern Rhodesia.
Zaire? No,
Zaire is the Belgian Congo. Zambia.
Zambia.
Yeah. Okay. I've got a perfect memory.
I
it's just the retrieval system.
I get those things all mixed up myself.
And he knew that copper belt. And this, my friend who came to help me in the Bureau then came up to Washington, to Julian Fias.
Mm-hmm.
It was down in that area, the geologist from Princeton,
mm-hmm.
and went out to Arizona, got his master's degree in geology, and he was in that campaign. He was looking for copper in the Africa, and they worked in the bush. Julian, for instance, he kept a diary at one time. He was out there with alone with a whole bunch of black men to carry his bags and so forth, and he had to feed them off their land.
Mm.
So he had to go off and shoot an animal every day or so.
Oh, no.
And he just described how he then gradually became routine and didn't want to keep track of it anymore.
Yeah.
And then he came back to the United States. He came from the Cleveland family. But is this important?
Well, it's interesting, yeah.
He had a fantastic memory. He knew everybody in the industry. He had been editor of the Mining Congress Journal when I hired him away from there to come into the Bureau of Mines. But when he came back from Africa, he was home, and he had a lady friend down the street, and he'd taken her out, and they were in walking distance. So they went to park his car and the family garage, and we heard a noise upstairs in the chauffeur's apartment upstairs. It was a pretty wealthy family. And the ladder was up, the stairway went upside, and she begged him not to go up. But he did. He went up there, and he couldn't find the light switch, so he struck his lighter and looked down, and the room was full of gas.
Mm.
And it blew up on him, and he didn't realize she hadn't paid any attention to what he said to do it. She was right following him, right behind her. And he had to pick her up and carry her out of these flames down the stairs. And she died as a result of that.
Mm.
And he got his face burned, his ears were burned off, and his nose were burned, and his lips were burned, and hands were burned. And he went into seclusion for a couple of years while they had 20 or 30 plastic surgical operations.
Right.
And he wouldn't go out seen by anybody. And finally he got over this, and he realized that this wasn't a good way to live. And he went back to geology, and he went up to Climax. Mm-hmm. He was the chief geologist at Climax when I met him first. And I admit that the first time you see him, it was quite a shock. But you soon forgot it. I was never aware of it. When the war came along, and he had a commission in the Army, and they weren't going to let him in because of all these troubles. And he asked the Board of Colonels to bring them in a typewriter and a 45 automatic. He took that 45 automatic apart, reassembled it, and put it out in front of them in 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
He took the typewriter and it was going just as fast as any secretary on the typewriter. So they let him in. Mm-hmm. So they sent him back to Africa as a captain or a major, I forget. And he was in the intelligence service, went into Ethiopia and worked with the Negus and so on. And but he had a fantastic memory. He was a very useful man to have around. But he had no administrative ability. So I had him in my office, and he would be sure that my speeches were written correctly. I would go home and write a speech, a dictator speech into a machine. Miss Harvey, my secretary, would transcribe it, and Julian would take it and take it around through the bureau to be sure that all the facts were right and that English was sound.
Mm-hmm.
So any resemblance between what I put into that machine and came out of my mouth at the meeting was purely coincidental.
Right.
That's how we wrote my speeches. And I was giving a speech one every week or so.
Surely.
And,
so he then from the bureau, did he follow you?
He came up to Kennecott with me.
I see.
And then when I left Kennecott to go to Copperaine.
But you were with Kennecott 10 years.
Nine,
okay, go on.
Yeah. And he came up almost immediately, and I had him doing this kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
When my successor took over my job in Kennecott, he didn't know what to do with Julian. He just didn't know how to use him. And so I called my friends, and I knew he was unhappy there.
Mm-hmm.
So I called my friends in the Geological Survey, and the new director by this time. And they were delighted. They'd like to have Julian back. And so
mm-hmm.
he went back to Washington
mm-hmm.
Until he retired and moved out to Southern California.
Right.
And we used to write, put it in a postcard in the typewriter and tap out a message to each other. And one time I noticed I hadn't heard from him for several weeks. And I heard from Jim Richardson. Yeah. You know Jim?
Mm-hmm.
Who came to Copper Rangers, my personnel vice president. And he said, you know, Julian's not very well, and he's kind of feeling lonely without you. And he said, it may be terminal. So I popped on an airplane, flew down to San Diego, and went and I spent 2 hours with him. And Ann says, I was the last visitor he had, so I'm fortunate.
Wow.
But he stayed wide awake for 2 hours. He'd been almost helpless for several weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But he got a very bad back because riding around in jeeps over the African roads had been pretty rough on him. And, But to me, he was an invaluable assistant.
But you knew how to use him.
Yeah, I knew how to use him, and Harry Burgess didn't.
Uh-huh. Now, did you go to Kennecott as vice president?
No, I went as the exploration manager.
Which was not vice president.
Not vice president. And then I've been doing it a while, and then they began to see what I was doing was important, and they advanced me to vice president in about 2 or 3 years, I think. So I must have been vice president for 5 or 6 years.
And Kennecott at that point was broadening all over the world.
Well, I was trying to broaden all over the world. The gold mines had come in, they were interested by Tony Gray had brought them in. And then I've been there not more than...
these were gold mines in Africa.
Yeah, we had Tony Gray knowing Africa. The man I went to work for, he was a vice president. I don't know what his title was, but he was a vice president. And I, as exploration manager, worked under him. And then in about 2 years, he quit and went and retired to England because he had most of his money in England. He'd been paid for his African work in pounds and he couldn't get them out.
Hmm.
And he married an English woman and he was really an English gentleman. His father was an English gentleman. Although he was born in Arizona. Very strange, I mean, a wonderful character, brilliant man, but a real curmudgeon. And a lot of people, friends of mine I've met in other places, couldn't work with him at all. But we got along famously, and he had confidence in what I did and backed me up, but I was more aggressive than he was. He had one drill working out in Arizona someplace, and he'd watch every morning for a report on what this old drill was. Before I'd been there 6 months, or six or 8 months, we had 20 or 30 drills going on all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Because the board were after us to do a lot more exploration. It wasn't costing you much.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did was to divide up the world into districts, and I had one, two, three, four, five districts in the United States, and I hired geologists to be the district geologists.
So this was a total of six districts.
Three in Canada on top of that.
Five in the United States.
And there were two in South America, in Central America, and one in Central America, one in South America. And then we did some work in Africa, the science, so we were all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
I had close to 100 geologists at one point. That's a big exploration
crew. Yes, indeed it is.
But when I went in there, I said to Mr. Cox, if I come, if you want me to be excellent, I said this to Charlie, to Anton Gray, I must have charge of the exploration work and the archaeological work on the properties. Well, they hesitated about that. And I said, love me, love my wife, you know, sort of thing. So they agreed. And I wanted to be able to have an independent look at the property. That was Bingham Canyon, Ray, Arizona, New Mexico. Sure, well, that's easy to pick
up. It wasn't too far back.
No.
But, let's see, so...
I can pick it up, I think.
And I asked you the question if this bypassed the managers.
Yeah, but the answer is no. We didn't bypass the managers, and the way we handled it was simply that these fellows, although they had to report to me and through the general manager I had in that field, in local property, that they were to act as guests, and although they weren't responsible to the general managers, they're responsible to me, they must get along with and work with them and become desirable citizens in the area. Mm-hmm. Then I don't think I mentioned the Bingham Canyon problem.
The
example for that was that one day a man I had in Bingham found out the way they were doing things and studying the geology and then laying out which part of the mine would go to the mill or which part would go to the dump. They were sending ore to the dump and rock to the mill.
Oh.
And how are we going to change it? I said, well, don't come to me and tell me about it. I'm going to forget you told me this thing. Well, I go to the vice president in charge of operations, and he goes down to the general manager and tells him, where will you get? You're going to be undesirable aliens. And I said, what you do is go and buy him a drink, take him out to dinner, and talk about this thing and point out how you can help them, how you the geology can help them send the right rock to the right place. Well, they made friends, and they became indispensable. Then the next thing they did was they needed an airplane map, so they could instantaneously find out what the pit looked like at any particular time.
This must have been very early in the use of aerial surveys, was it, for mining?
Oh, I think so, probably.
Probably.
Yeah, it was still fairly, well, it wasn't new because this man knew he had to have those airplane photographs. He'd worked with them before, so it was already, the war did a lot of this.
Mm-hmm.
This was well after the war.
Mm-hmm.
So we took the photographs, and when he took those photographs, they could bring an accurate map within a week of having flown it, or even, I think, sometimes a matter of a day or two. Then they could take it to the manager, and they took that to the managers and enough to the people who were responsible for surveying. And they didn't send it up to me, and I sent it down.
Mm.
And that meant the managers began to get confidence in me. And I got invited into the managerial discussions later on.
But at first they resented your taking their geologists out of the
I don't think Millikan ever did. He was a stickler for organization.
Mm-hmm.
It hurt his organizational power.
Mm-hmm.
To have somebody working in an area who wasn't responsible to a guy that's in the property.
Mm-hmm.
It's an unusual thing, but this way you have to do geology.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, we got down to Latin America and to Chile at El Teniente, and I sent a geologist down there, two geologists, and they came back and they said, bypassing ore, great masses of ore. There was one massive, millions of tons of 2% ore, which was high grade in those days. And they will lose it. They go and mine underneath and don't take it as they go down. And then we had to maneuver that so that the general manager down there understand what was happening. Well, they got pretty angry because they had to change the whole mining mining plan. But they knew in their hearts that they we were right about it. Mm-hmm. But there we were. Nobody was really doing the geology in El Teniente. For the time from Bateman, you've heard of mm-hmm. Alan Bateman.
Right.
Alan did it, and Lindgren was down there. But that was years before. There'd never been a geologist in the place to map it and study it and so forth.
Hmm.
They had to start with Lindgren and Bateman's work, but they did that, and they began to do the geology, and they were able to help guide the mining plans.
Hmm.
So if I made a contribution to Connecticut, who was that? But it was organizational. I didn't do it myself. I mean, I didn't have what I know about the geology of El Teniente. What I know about the geology of Bingham, except what these boys came back and told me.
Did you send in the right people who did?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Now, you had mentioned the man that you brought from Australia. Who had
John Sullivan, and he brought with him Frank Joklik.
How is that spelled?
J-O-K-I-L-I-K-I. And I asked him how he's pronounced. He will have broad, straight neck. It's gone now.
Okay. He was Austrian,
Yeah, his father was Austrian. Was a consul in Australia when the war came along, in the First World War, and he couldn't get back. He took out his Australian citizenship, and Jock was born in Australia.
Uh-huh.
And
Sullivan was Australian.
And Sullivan was an Australian. They were high up in the Australian Geological Survey.
Uh-huh.
And when I got them here, I put them into Canada. And Jock cut his foot with an axe in the field. And while he was recuperating, I sent him to, he couldn't be out in the field much, to the Harvard Business School. Cause he was a international scholar. Come over here, one of the senators.
Fulbright?
Hmm?
Fulbright?
Fulbright. He was a Fulbright scholar. He got his doctor's degree over here.
Hmm.
And I saw his reports coming in from Canada, beautifully written, and he really understood what he was saying and did. And so I thought, this is a comer. So a waste of his time with a sore foot, I sent him off to the Harvard Business School. And so then Frank Jock, when I was leaving Connecticut, Frank Milliken said, well, what do I do with Jock? I said, this is the best brains you got in the company, Frank. You better send him out to the West and teach him how to run rock properties. And he didn't do that immediately, but eventually he did. He did send him out to properties. But about that time, Amex came back at him and wanted to go back to Australia to straighten out that iron ore mess they had out there. And then, at that time, I wanted him to come to Kenneth with me to Copper Range, and he would have been president of Copper Range. And later, maybe we wouldn't have ever left it go the way we did. But he was falling in love with a very beautiful airplane hostess, Pamela, but she didn't want to settle down yet. If he came to me, then he would have to go up to White Pine and be out in the bush, and she was too used to traveling around. So they were married. Then he went with Amex. And then with this Australian thing meant he'd been traveling all the time. And so he came back to Kennecott. And they put him out in the in Bingham, in Utah. And he's now president of the Kennecott part of Standard Oil of Ohio. Ohio.
Hmm.
Right, Sammy and I had dinner with him in Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
On Sunday night. And they came to me with a long black limousine. You saw all those around me, how they took care of the power to be out there. And we went out to a restaurant out the sticks someplace, and we had a very wonderful time together.
Mm-hmm.
Well, another one of our geologists was a Frenchman. I went down to the school, and I went to Stanford, and I talked to Charlie Parks out there, and I picked three or four people I brought into Connecticut from their graduate school, and one of them was a Frenchman who had to go back and serve his time in the French army. So I hired him and agreed that, and then I didn't go to do some work in North Africa. Then he came back and I sent him out to join in, gave him a chance to try out when he came back.
Mm-hmm.
And he went with Charlie, who fellow succeeded me as vice president when I left Connecticut. Now then, Harvard guy, Sundercom Bradley, glad he graduated. He looked down his nose at me, a trade school boy from Caltech. And I put him in charge of the central of the United States. And he had his office in Duluth. What's the big town in Minnesota?
Minneapolis.
And I went up there to visit him one time, and he said, I'm going to take you out to Charlie's Hamburger Heaven. Well, Charlie's Hamburger Heaven is about the finest restaurant on that side of the Mississippi River.
Oh, really?
And we had a big round table, and they had a Lazy Susan in the middle, and they spun this around, and they said to me that the head waiter was over my shoulder, but you can't tell me what that is. So I took this thing and I bit on it, and I looked up in the air very wisely, and I said, that's a Jerusalem artichoke. And Mal dropped up, how do you know it? I said, Charlie, I've been around. Well, my mother used to have, you call them root artichokes, but we call them Jerusalem artichokes. My mother used to give us some cream sauce in England. I remember that flavor, that taste to all those years. So then I think he changed his opinion. He thought maybe I knew something.
Now, who was this?
That's Charlie.
The one who succeeded you at Kennecott.
Yeah, that's...
I see.
Well, pop in my mind. He's not passed on there.
Well,
Charles... It'll be coming up in a
minute. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you brought somebody who was French, and I don't think I
It came out of the French army. I sent him to this Charlie, his office, and he began to work in the central United States.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, when I brought Charles to New York,
mm-hmm.
pronounced his name in French, and then he anglicized it. Mm-hmm. And he became the president of Occidental Minerals, the oil company's minerals operation, under the fellow, the famous president of Occidental.
Herman Hammer.
He worked with, he got tired of working with Herman Hammer. Mm-hmm. So now he's got his own company in Denver. Burgess. Harry Burgess, not Charles. Harry Burgess. Charles Harry Burgess, but we call him Harry. I always call him Hot Lips Harry because he could take a cup of coffee right off the stove and drink it.
Now, he was not the Frenchman. He was your successor.
No, that was the man that succeeded me.
Okay.
He was a Harvard graduate, cum summa cum laude. He worked in the for the government in the Lend-Lease, not the Lend-Lease, Marshall Plan operations. And then he came to me, I'd worked with him, so I knew him quite well, and wanted a job, and I gladly hired him and sent him up to, because he was a geologist, basically. Mm-hmm. Now he came down, took my place, and then he and Feist, because I left my secretary behind so I could bring her into my, when I went to see Cox, I'd try to see him for two or three days. I knew I was only had two vice presidents, and I wanted to see him, and I sometimes wouldn't see him for 2 days. Mm-hmm. So he sent for me, and he was coming to his office, and he was taking some soda or things like this, making, must have heartburn. You want to see me? I said, yes. What do you want to talk to me about? I said, well, I have been offered and accepted the presidency of the Copper Range Company. Who are you going to take with you? I said, I hadn't thought about taking anybody with me, but I might like to take my secretary. That's how I left Kennedy.
Hmm.
But from there on, he never asked me to come to his office. He came down to see me. I was now on a level with him, you see. And he'd been in the steel industry. He'd been president of one of the subsidiaries of U.S. Steel.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a great mistake.
Hmm. But you worked under him.
I worked under
him for a long time.
Well, it got the point that everything I tried to do, he scotched.
Mm.
For instance, I came up from the copper, from the Bureau of Mines. I had all this information at my fingertips about what minerals were needed and what their future was and where they came from and what needed to be expanded. And I wrote him a report, and I said, this is what we ought to be doing if I'm going to be the exploration manager. These are minerals we want to go out and do, and we can expand it away from copper and broaden out the sugar. He took that report, which I worked on for weeks, put it in the file, and never even acknowledged he received it. Bit by bit, I began to get it. I got some mines in Nigeria, and we did work. And then I opened up the stuff in South America and in Alaska, and then got into Canada. But then every time I wanted to get anything done, I was in Greece, the only deposit of asbestos in Europe. We discovered that, and that wasn't due to a geological discovery, it was due to our relationships with people that we were working with. And they scotched that. So then when they came and sent the body snatchers out to offer me the job of Copper Range, I said this to Ruth. I said, hey, well, this man, they offered me this change. She said, well, I don't know anything about the new job, she said, Jenny, but I know this, that you can't stay where you are. It's killing you, destroying you. And I didn't realize that's what I was doing. She was just bearing the butt of it, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So I accepted it. Well, actually, I suppose that I did better financially, and certainly it was much more fun running a company of my own than it was being under this kind of a, and Milliken wouldn't have been any better, because Milliken was 10 years younger than I was. And it was obvious that he was the heir presumptive, that he was going to be the president.
He was the other vice president?
He was the other vice president.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He had charge of the mines, and I had charge of the exploration.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had a research director who really was a vice president, too. But that's all. That great big corporation on the internet.
Small organization?
Yeah. There was a woman there that when the Guggenheim set up Connecticut, was it the Guggenheims? Yeah. That in the beginning, she was the only secretary of the place. She kept the file, she wrote all the letters, she did them. And when I got there, she was about to retire, and she was the file clerk, and she had six file clerks.
Oh, think of it.
And then the accounting department, she did all the books too. The accounting department came on, they had a whole floor in our building, in the Chrysler building.
Hmm. How things have changed.
They each of the mines, they had a whole building that had the IBM 630 computers. Poured out figures, which they used to send me. I don't know what to do with them. It doesn't mean anything to me.
Oh. Well, do you think this is a good place, perhaps, to stop?
Yeah, it's 4:30.